Sounds like we're ready to proceed. All right, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are on our second oral argument for today, and I will ask the marshal to call that case. I'll have just a few quick remarks before we go ahead with appellant's argument.
Now calling case 821-0346, MythLive 2, Inc. versus City of Maplewood.
All right, and I see counsel before us. We are hearing this matter via video conferencing the Zoom application. In all other respects, our procedures are the same as they are in the courtroom. We are recording this, and so I will call to your attention that you should begin your remarks by identifying yourself as well as the client you represent. And then keep your eye on the clock. It should be visible on the screen. It will count down, and it tends to go quickly. So we very much look forward to our conversation with you. With that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrew Bardwell. I'm one of the attorneys for the appellant, MythLive 2, Inc. There are really two issues here today. First, did the district court improperly decide a disputed issue of material fact by concluding there was an agreement between Myth and the City of Maplewood? Appellant contends that it did. Second, did the district court base its decision on inadmissible settlement communications in violation of Rule of Evidence 408? Again, the answer is yes. I'm going to start with a brief recitation of facts, then I will discuss the standard of review when the district court has improperly decided a fact question on summary judgment. I'm going to do that not because I believe the panel really needs a refresher on first-year civil procedure, but simply because it is crucial to this case. Afterwards, I will point the court to evidence in the record that demonstrates a reasonable person could have drawn a different conclusion than the district court, rendering summary judgment inappropriate. Finally, I will explain how the district court's reliance on the transcript of a meeting that was undeniably a settlement conference violated Rule 408. In closing, I will ask the court to reverse the district court's decision and remand for a trial on the merits. I'm going to assume that the panel is generally familiar with the facts, so I'll be brief in my recitation of them. The whole issue started on March 29, 2019, when an unknown gunman fired shots from the parking lot of the Wingate Townhomes development in Maplewood. One of those shots struck a patron of the Myth who had attended a concert that evening and was returning to his vehicle in an overflow parking lot. We know the shooting actually occurred in the Wingate Townhomes parking lot because that's where the police recovered the shell casings. The individual who was struck by the bullet had been a patron of the Myth, but he'd not been involved in any altercation or dispute at the Myth. The City of Maplewood immediately jumped to the conclusion that somehow this shooting was related to the operation of Myth. They publicly announced there'd been a shooting at the Myth. At the very next city council meeting on April 8th, the council directed the Director of Public Safety, Chief Nadeau, to develop what they referred to as an Operational Action Plan, or OAP. And this was a document they'd used previously with respect to an unrelated nightclub in Maplewood. And what it amounted to was potential conditions or restrictions that the city wanted to impose on the Myth's liquor license. After that meeting, at that meeting, the mayor also directed the representatives of Myth to cooperate with the chief of police, Chief Nadeau, and to meet with him and to discuss this plan, which the Myth did. In addition to cooperating and having those meetings with Director Nadeau or Chief Nadeau, the Myth also voluntarily, on its own accord, retained the services of former Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanek.
So, Mr. Bardwell, if yes. I may. Here's a point I just would like you to clarify based upon the record. Is it fair to say on each of those drafts of the operation action plan is the word, whether it's the one they looked at first on Stargate or the one used at the council meeting, is it fair to say that each of them at the end of those drafts, there was that closure language, you know, upon evidence of substantial noncompliance, which I understand you're saying your client did not agree to. I mean, I just want to know, was the language there in all those documents that were in front of them?
Your Honor, it was there on several of the documents. I believe there was at least one that did not include it. There were several versions of that plan that went back and forth, and I believe one was titled Considerations or something to that effect, and it did not include that provision. But I will point out for the court that in the meetings with Chief Nadeau that were recorded, there was never any discussion of that closure provision. It was never brought up, it was never discussed, and it was certainly never agreed to. The same is true at the city council meeting that occurred. There was no discussion whatsoever of that closure provision. And that closure provision really is the most important and most onerous of the provisions that were included in the OAP. It gave the chief of police essentially unfettered discretion. In his estimation, if there was evidence of substantial noncompliance, he could close the entire operation of the myth until the next meeting of the city council.
Mr. Barber, if I may. Is it fair to say the language isn't there? It wasn't explicitly addressed in either the June 5th or June 10th meeting, but it was never specifically objected to either. Is that fair to say?
That is correct. And if the court were to review what occurred at the city council meeting, it's clear, and Mayor Abrams actually admitted this in her deposition, that after she announced there was an agreement three separate times, she refused to allow Myth's representatives an opportunity to respond to that claim. And that's compounded by the fact that Myth's letter to the city attorney from May 31st, where Myth was clear that the city did not have authority to impose conditions, that Myth had voluntarily taken actions, but objected to the imposition of conditions, and it could lead to a lawsuit. That was withheld from the city council record at the June 10th meeting. If that had been included in the record, everyone would have known there was a dispute and no agreement. And that implicates the Rostam Khani case that we cited, where a very similar thing happened. The appellant in that case had sent a letter to a city council member containing some information about his ability or willingness to do repairs on a property. That city council member did not provide the letter to any of the other members of the city council, and at a meeting actually said something that was contradicted by the letter. Withholding that letter from the record was enough to render that decision arbitrary and capricious. Exactly what happened here.
Isn't that different, Mr. Barbel, from what happened here? Because here, I think the letter was on the 31st of May. Then there was the meeting on June 5th before the council meeting on the 10th. Isn't that a different factual situation?
You know, I don't know that the order really matters that much, Your Honor. And certainly the district court did focus on that. But I believe that focus was inappropriate. When evaluating whether or not a contract has been formed, you have to look at all of the circumstances. And all of the circumstances include that letter that was very clear. And had the record been, had that letter been introduced during the city council meeting, certainly at least the question would have been asked, do you agree? And Myth clearly did not agree. And the mayor acknowledged that she did not give the Myth an opportunity to respond to her claim that Myth agreed. And if you actually review the language that the mayor used, three separate times she stated something along the lines of you agreed. And each time she becomes a little more forceful, like she's trying to convince herself that there was an agreement. And she very clearly did not allow Myth to respond to that claim. Had she allowed Myth that opportunity, we probably wouldn't be here today. I think it's undisputed that the city did not have the authority to impose these conditions absent an agreement. And I would posit to the court that withholding the letter and not allowing Myth to respond was intentional because the city knew it didn't have the authority to impose conditions without an agreement. The fact that the letter contradicted directly what the mayor said puts this squarely in the holding of the Rostam Khani case. Now, again, it's important that the city did not have the authority to do this absent some agreement. And that's what we refer to as the Gabby's case. That is the In Re On Sale Liquor License Class B 763 Northwest 2nd at 359. That's a Minnesota Court of Appeals case from 2009. And that case is on all fours with this one. The city of Minneapolis imposed conditions on an already existing liquor license. And the court actually found two problems with that. First, the language in the statute that the ordinance that the court relied on was too vague. That was a due process violation. And second, The conclusion was that the city had exceeded its authority because none of the statutes or the ordinances gave it the authority to impose conditions on an active liquor license. That's exactly what happened here. The city imposed conditions on an active liquor license. The Maplewood ordinance gives it the authority to revoke or suspend a license, just like Minneapolis did, but those criteria weren't met. And in the event that a license is suspended or revoked, the Administrative Procedure Act is actually implicated by the ordinance itself. There is supposed to be notice and a hearing and the ability to present witnesses and cross-examine. None of that stuff was provided here.
I just want to clarify a couple of things, and I might be confused on the facts, and I'm sure you can help me out. So you mentioned that the city has authority to revoke or suspend a license and argue they didn't have authority to just add conditions to the license, so they needed the agreement. Now, correct. The city has other options available as well. And as I recall, the MIF was subject to some notices of violations, I believe ordinance violations for nuisance. Isn't that right?
The city did enact a new nuisance ordinance. That is correct.
No, what I'm asking about is whether you've been cited, MIF had been cited for violations.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Had MIF been cited for nuisance violations?
There was, I believe, one citation for a nuisance violation. But if there was going to be an action taken to suspend or revoke based on that, MIF was entitled to a hearing.
I understand. Totally different process. Yeah, I understand. And then wasn't there also some discussion about fines? And I don't know if that's related to the nuisance violations. And maybe you can help me out.
I believe that the city did have some authority to impose fines. Again, I think those, however, related to violations of liquor laws. And there's in the ordinance and in this corresponding state statute, there are certain violations that allow adverse action to be taken. And those are generally violation of liquor laws, permission of gambling, things like that, which certainly are not implicated here. Now, if I've answered the court's question, I would like to move on to what the court actually concluded here. The court decided there was a contract, in essence, a settlement agreement. The MIF had agreed to these things. In order for there to be a settlement agreement, it's analyzed the same way a contract is analyzed. And whether or not there's a contract is a question of fact. That's Gresser v. Hotzler that we cited. Minnesota also adheres to the mirror image rule. And in a nutshell, what that means is there must be an agreement to the same terms at the same time. That certainly did not happen here. The transcript of the June 5th meeting shows a number of disputes between Mr. Skolnick, who was Smith's attorney, and Chief Nadeau, where they essentially agreed to disagree. Mr. Skolnick informed Chief Nadeau that Smith had already reached out to the city attorney and told the city attorney, you don't have authority. Now, there's a discrepancy between the city's transcript and Smith's transcript of that. The two different court reporters came up with a slightly different transcript of what was actually said, but the import's the same. There was certainly no agreement. And nowhere in that transcript is any discussion, let alone agreement, to the closure provision. Again, at the city council meeting, there was no discussion, let alone agreement to that closure provision. There cannot be an agreement. There cannot be a contract unless there's an agreement to all material terms. So that is not present here.
Would you agree, Mr. Bardwell, that, and I've read the transcripts, I'm sure I'm not as familiar with them as you are, but that if you look at the transcript on June 10th, there was an agreement between the parties on the limitations on the license. There was just never explicit discussion of the closure agreement. Isn't that fair to say?
I don't believe that it is, Your Honor, because there's a fundamental difference between agreeing. If you look at the language that Chief Nadeau used over and over again, he said, I'm going to make a recommendation, a recommendation, a recommendation. He never said this is a requirement. This is going to be imposed. Myth certainly may have agreed that the chief was going to make those recommendations. In fact, Mr. Skolnick said, you're free to make whatever recommendation you want. That is a far cry from the MIF agreeing that the city could vote to impose these conditions. We agree that we're going to work and try and improve our operation is different than you can impose an adverse condition on our license. There's another point in that transcript where Chief Nadeau describes what he views the document to be. And what he says is this document, in my opinion, does nothing more than try and communicate the community expectations for the continuing success and safety of the Myth. That doesn't sound to me like he was saying, you are agreeing the city can impose these conditions. Your license is going to be subject to adverse provisions. That is nowhere in the transcript. It was not discussed before the city council. There could not have been an agreement. That specific closure provision also is clearly void for vagueness. The substantial noncompliance is not defined. Nobody understands it. Council members Juneman and Neblett both testified they didn't understand what it meant. They didn't know what standard would be used to review it.
Did you make this argument, Mr. Bardwell, about the void for vagueness to the district court in response to the summary judgment motion?
It was certainly in the briefing. I don't know if it was discussed during the hearing itself, but it was absolutely in the briefing. And there's actually some language in the Gabby's case that relates to that directly. To satisfy due process, the ordinance must provide sufficient objective standards to control the discretion of the governing authority and must give adequate notice to the licensee of the criteria used to permit adverse action against the licensee. That's certainly not there in that closure provision, as evidenced by the fact that the city council members who would be enforcing it couldn't define it. I see that my time is up, unless the panel has any more questions.
And of course, Mr. Bardwell, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Understood.
Okay. All right, the clock has been reset. So, counsel for respondent, we're ready for you when you are.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Ravers, and I represent the respondent, the city of Maplewood. We ask that the court affirm the district court's dismissal of this matter on summary judgment. I want to just touch on a few things here on, you know, some factual issues, and then get into the heart of this thing on the agreement to the conditions. And the statutory basis here, the Minnesota Statute 340A.415 authorizes parties to agree to conditions. So that's the statutory authority. And this is not an uncommon situation. And we've cited the court to a number of cases, but I think the one that's most similar is the Metro Bar and Grill case. And again, a situation where there's a homicide, a shooting, and then the licensee agrees to conditions to address the public safety concerns of the city. So it's not an uncommon situation for license holders to agree to conditions. This is not a typical contract case. It's did they agree to it? Did they consent to it? And on this record, they did. And it's really no different than you've got a land use case or a situation where there's a permit holder, there's concerns raised, people agree to conditions to mitigate those concerns. That happens routinely in government permitting processes. And here, you know, this was a culmination. So this shooting, you know, there's a notion that the city is making the Myth a scapegoat. You know, here on March 29th, this is the culmination of 2 years of issues the city has had. And I just want to point the court to a few things in the record that I think are important. You know, and this is Exhibit 6. I don't have the document index number because the way the district court put these together, it's a little hard to pinpoint it. But I'll just point it to my affidavit is Exhibit 6. And what that is really a compilation of all the things that have happened over the last 2 years. So this is not just an isolated situation. And there's a suggestion that it wasn't a, you know, this had nothing to do with the Myth. And I'll just point the court, there's the transcript of the June 10th meeting, you know, the Mr. Jess or Mr. Sanchez, he's the security supervisor, acknowledges, and this is on page 41 of that transcript on March 29th. Yes, it happened outside in our parking lot. It's a parking lot contracted by them. There's no evidence in the record people are shopping at Ashley Furniture around midnight. This person's shot. The news is not that the city says, hey, and this was news when people get shot, and this is in the record too. St. Paul teen shot in neck near Myth nightclub in Maplewood. This was the problem they had, and the city had a legitimate public safety concern with the situation. So that's the backdrop of here. And I think what's important, the transcripts of all the meetings are here. So the unique part about this case is we've got a transcript of every single meeting that are germane to the district court's determination, which supports summary judgment. And I think the court needs to start with the April 8th meeting, the transcript, because the city attorney references, and this is on pages 15 and 16 of that transcript, and also pages 20, where he talks about consent, you know, that the statute envisions, and it's on page 20, the statute envisions that they can agree to voluntarily agree to by the permit holder. So this is the backdrop, the city attorney giving them the framework. And the last motion, the motion at the end of that transcript on page 46, Mayor Abrams, with that, I will make a motion that our chief engage in discussions with staff representatives from the MIF in regards to creating an operational action plan. So the direction was to work together, come up with a plan to address these concerns. And they did that. And we've got the transcripts. Again, my colleague mentioned, I think there was a question from Judge Jessen about, was that closure provision in there? And the answer is unequivocally yes. There's no dispute. What my colleague referenced was, hey, I think there was one that didn't have it at the very first meeting. And this is in the record, Exhibit 22, again, to my affidavit. It's actually Exhibit A to former Sheriff Stanek's report. What the city showed up at the first meeting and said, here, we've got the Stargate OAP was the template. And then they also said, here's 21 additional considerations. And they melded those together. And the transcript of the May 9th meeting shows, here it is. We call it the Stargate. Here's our draft report. We melded these together. So it's undisputed that throughout all of this, that the Stargate was the template. That recommendation was always there. And it's clear that we did get the May 31 letter. So the May 31 letter comes in, and that is Exhibit 22. And there it talks about the unilateral imposition of onerous conditions. But then we sit down and they go line by line through 34 conditions.
Mr. Rivers, if I'm following you, I think you're at the June 5th meeting now, right? Where they go line by line. So the June 5th meeting, the argument I heard from Mr. Bardwell is that there was no discussion of this now hotly contested requirement or authority given to the chief of police to close MIF upon a violation of any of the conditions. So you agree with that, I think, at least I didn't see a disagreement in your brief, that there was no discussion at the June 5th meeting of that particular.
There was no specific discussion, but I have two responses to that. Number one, in Sheriff Stanek's report, where he walks through line by line any concerns with the draft report, makes no objection to that. At the meeting itself, and this is on page 77 of that transcript, the chief concludes with, is there anything else we should chat about? Giving them full opportunity to raise an objection, raise any concern with that provision. And they said nothing. In fact, the only concern is...
Here's what I'm struggling with from a contracts analysis. So you have these written proposals that are exchanged, and it do include the closure term, which is adopted at the June 10th meeting by City Council. But we don't ever have an affirmative statement, as we do for so many all the other conditions at the June 5th meeting, except for two that were dropped. We don't ever have a verbal acquiescence. At least I didn't see evidence of it in the record. So maybe I missed it. If you'd help me out.
There was certainly nothing where they said, yes, we agree to that, but they had an obligation to come and say, we object to that, because they know this is coming to the city council. And this is the letter from... But
if I understand you right, the city council can't impose these conditions unilaterally. They have to have agreement. Isn't that right? Or do I misunderstand that?
They needed we acknowledge they needed an agreement, and they had that. And that's how it was presented to the council. Again, when this meeting was set for June 5th, it's the cover letter, and this is Exhibit 21, the purpose of the meeting. The purpose of the meeting is to finalize the OAP for the city council's consideration. They're showing up knowing that this is going to be presented. That provision is there. It's on the draft. Again, no objection. And even at the June 10th meeting, there's no objection there. The transcript is clear. They had a full opportunity. Mr. Skolnick spoke. Mr. You know, they had all their representatives, Sheriff Stanek. I think the other critical piece on that June 10th that I want to point the court to is Sheriff Stanek. He says, again, he's the one who commented on everything. And he says, but it really, he goes, and this is on page 24, but it really comes down to these last two. One, the 1.5 ounce pour standard, which you just addressed, they agreed to. And secondly, having some discussion, Mayor and City Council members, about magnetometers, metal detectors. And again, so, undisputed, that wasn't included.
Mr. Ravers, if I may, is there a difference between, from the statutory case law analysis, between saying there must be agreement to the limitations on the license and arguably what's here, which is kind of an enforcement provision if there's not substantial compliance to those limitations? So that's my question. And when was that addressed before the district court?
I don't think there is any difference. I think the idea, I think the district court viewed the condition, the OAP as a whole, and it was presented, is discussed throughout. Again, there's just no objection to it. And so our view is that they acquiesced to that. They didn't object to it. If they don't say anything, it's certainly the city, there's nothing the record suggests that there is any problem with it. We're going to do all this stuff. We're fine with everything. Nobody says a peep, and that's undisputed about that provision, and it's undisputed it was front and center at every single meeting. And again, when they appear at the city council meeting, again, this is why the transcripts are critical. And I think it's just the most important things are the transcripts of all of these meetings, certainly their letter. But again, there was no unilateral imposition. And when Mr. Skolnick addresses the city council, there's no, hey, city council, you have no authority to do this. Don't do that. There's no objection, period. They're expert, no objection, period. Thinking like, hey, we've addressed the two things that were not aligned. Those got, they're in place now. On this record and based on these transcripts that we have, and again, this is the unique part here, is I think you can look at exhibits six and basically 2019 through 24, I think, are the critical exhibits for the court, for the record that the city relies upon here. That formed the basis. There would be no reason to wordsmith. I mean, again, we put these throughout our brief. I mean, the citations to each of the things, Mr. Skolnick, wordsmithing, because one of the suggestions that appellants made in their opening brief was, hey, there was one issue that we didn't agree to on underage drinking. If you really look at the full transcript, which we provided the court, once the sergeant steps in and says, well, how about continue monitoring? And Mr. Skolnick, good, easy, we agree. And you'll see that's replete throughout. And if this was just there to, hey, we don't care what you do, it doesn't make any sense. And that's what the district court found. And
if I may, so appellant raises the question of rules of evidence 408, mm-hmm. you know, for the use of the June 5th transcript. Mm-hmm. From your perspective, do we really need to look at that, or is the evidence that you're pointing to for agreement also can that also be found in the June 10th transcript?
It's a red herring in our view, Your Honor. I mean, it was kind of a unique. We're arguing summary judgment. The transcript's in the record here, and it's kind of out of the blue. The district court says, "Hey, could this be a settlement?" I mean, this is never raised until the district court just kind of throws a kind of a question out there. Doesn't even address it in the order. Again, this is no different than any permitting type case. Hey, go try to work it out. If you had a conditional use permit and the people trying to work it out, that would be part of the record. So this is not a settlement discussion where the city's trying to, you know, resolve some liability issue. We're here, we'll give you X dollars to do this. That's not that kind of discussion. Again, the motion at the very beginning that pointed the court was go work with the myth, come up with a plan and bring it back to us. They did that. And on this record, again, they had a full and fair opportunity to address the council. Once the motion was made, the council moved forward. I mean, this notion that, hey, we would have objected, at that point, the council had already acted. Again, we've got the transcripts, and we rely on those because they were given full and fair opportunity to address any concern, raise any objection, any, and they're just not there. And it's, again, on this record, viewing facts in the light most favorable to the appellant, the city prevails because there's only one reasonable interpretation. That's what the district court found. And we rely on certainly the district court's analysis did a really fine job of walking through And I certainly the court will utilize that, but the city would rely on certainly the district court's analysis on how we got here. And again, on this record, there was an agreement that they would deal with. And frankly, if you look at these items, they're not very, they're basically, they said, we're doing them anyway. None of these are onerous distinctions. And for these reasons, you know, we ask the court to affirm the district court. Unless there's any other questions, that's all I have. Thank you.
Looks like there aren't any other questions for the panel. So thank you very much, Mr. Reivers. And with that, we'll reset the clock for rebuttal. So we are ready for you, Counsel for Appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, this is Andrew Bardwell on behalf of the appellant. Mr. Reivers mentioned one very important point. This action that the city took was based on 2 years of events. The licensee of the MIF, the holder of the liquor license, obtained that liquor license in January of 2019. She was not the licensee during those prior events. So the city admits that it used prior history under other owners to take adverse action against the new licensee. That's a violation of the law under the Gabby's case and also Wadja versus City of Minneapolis. You can't blame a new owner for the last owner's bad act. It's akin to you buy a used car and then you get a speeding ticket because the previous owner drove too fast. That's a due process violation. But in terms of Rule 408, which I didn't get to touch on initially, it was certainly a settlement discussion. That June 5th meeting occurred after MIF sent the letter to the city attorney threatening a lawsuit. If you continue down this road, if you do these things, we will sue. The dispute was already in existence. This is not a situation, as Mr. Reivers suggests, where it was a conditional use permit or we're trying to get something issued. MIF already had a liquor license in its possession. The city was trying to take adverse action against that license. The city didn't have the authority to do so. So liability here is based on the agreement. The city could not have taken the action without the agreement. The agreement allegedly is found in that June 5th meeting. So that makes it a clear violation of Rule 408. It shouldn't have been considered. Evidence on summary judgment must be admissible at trial. This evidence was not admissible. But even if it's considered, there's still obviously a dispute. Chief Nadeau admitted in his deposition that MIF never even saw the final plan until the June 10th meeting. If MIF never saw the final plan, how could it have consented? And there's nothing in the record at that June 10th meeting where MIF consents. No one has pointed out where MIF agreed to that closure provision because MIF did not agree to it. And again, as I stated before, there's a vast difference between agreeing, we're going to work on these things. We want to have a good operation. We want a relationship with the city, and agreeing that the city can impose conditions. The chief repeatedly said, I'm going to make recommendations. Myth said, make whatever recommendations you want, understanding it would have a chance to address the council. But after the mayor made the false statements that Myth agreed, the mayor did not give MIF an opportunity to respond. And nowhere in that record did MIF assent to that closure provision. Without that agreement, without some affirmative act on behalf of MIF, there is no contract, there is no agreement to impose those conditions. All of the cases that the city relies on, there was no dispute that there was an agreement. In one of them, the licensee submitted an application that included conditions. In another, there was a writing. There was always some actual agreement. Nobody disputed that there was an agreement. That wasn't addressed in those cases. Here, the dispute is whether or not there was an agreement. And even if MIF ultimately doesn't prevail at trial, the question simply is, could reasonable minds differ about whether or not there was an agreement? And on this record, I think that is abundantly clear. Evidenced by the fact that the city intentionally withheld MIF's letter to the city attorney from the June 10th meeting. Chief Nadeau, who prepared the packet for the council, acknowledged that he withheld that document. Had that document been included, it would have been obvious that there was no agreement. And without an agreement, the city could not do what it did. If there was already an agreement in place, the Myth would not have even needed to attend that city council meeting. There was no agreement. Myth was there to object. The mayor did not allow Myth to object, which she conceded in her deposition. On this record, there was a fact dispute. It was improperly decided by the court. And I again respectfully request that the decision be reversed and remanded for a trial on the merits. Does the panel have any further questions for me?
Thank you very much, counsel. It looks like we have concluded our